How do we work with a client's resistance when their body is in a heightened state of alert? According to Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, we first have to acknowledge the important role of resistance. And this becomes a bigger challenge when clients are also struggling with the effects of a past trauma. Here, Bessel suggests a new angle on a bottom-up approach that can help clients calm the nervous system.
The nature of trauma is that you don't want to relive it. You want to not have the trauma. You don't want to talk about the trauma. You don't want to revisit it because it messed you up and it's overwhelmed. And so the nature of traumatic stress is an inability to revisit that. And so people will put up every possible barrier to be traumatized again. And you can call that resistance. I would call that sort of a healthy way of trying to cope. And if people don't... I had a good case this morning of a guy who is a Vietnam veteran, and he doesn't want to talk to anybody who doesn't have a maximum security clearance, because he would have to violate his security clearance by talking about whatever. I happen to know that scene quite well, because I've treated many guys like that, and they were probably members of a death squad. There was a lot of death squads in Vietnam, U.S. sponsored death squads, as they are today in Afghanistan, and you have clearance and you're not allowed to talk about it. And so his wife says to me, "Oh, my husband, do you have maximum security clearance? Because my husband cannot talk to anybody without clearance." I said, "Cool, thank you. I'll bring this up with Ruth today." Because so people don't want to talk about how they were a member of the death squad. And then they have a resistance. And you always go with the resistance. If people say, "You don't have maximum security clearance, I cannot talk about it," you go like, "Wow, that's really important. So what would happen if you violated the secrecy? And how did this oath come about? And is this a mutual thing that they hold to their promises and you hold to yours? Or is it a one-way street? And are you like the Japanese soldiers who are still defending the emperor 50 years after Japan has become Americanized at the end of the Second World War?" And so you go with it. You honor defenses. And very central in all the work that IFS does, structures do, but all these defenses are there for a reason. They came from a position of trying to protect yourself. So there's always the question of, so what do you think would happen if, or what's the voice in your head that you hear if you would violate this? And you get very interested in these internal prohibitions. And I see it in people who, a very important part of dealing with trauma is to learn to activate your autonomic nervous system in a way that you calm your brainstem down, so you can calm your limbic system down, so you can get your frontal lobes online. So it's also bottom-up work. And if you cannot breathe, and you breathe very shallowly, and you cannot really get that heart rate variability going, you cannot get better. And a lot of people are very afraid to breathe deeply. And so you need to really seduce them into slowly take a deep breath and say, "Let's see what happens if you blow a bubble. Let's see what happens if you make an ohm sound. Ooh, I hated it. Good. So that didn't work. So how about what happens if you breathe and you make a movement like this, like in Qigong?" "Yeah, that's okay. So let's do that a little bit more." And then you discover, being a researcher, you see the background of that the reason that people don't want to take deep breath is because they keep themselves uptight, because the moment they start feeling something, they get overwhelmed. Yeah? So there's always a reason why people resist certain things. And you go with the resistance. You honor the resistance. And you see that the resistance is part of how people have survived that. And you ask, How long have you held your breath? How long have you made sure you never talk about anything for fear of tendency? How long has this been going on? How old is that part of you that tells you ta 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 ta? And how did this part come into being? And so you're deeply curious about that part to help people to survive. It's all part of the, so it's not bad. It's a part of who people are. To have survived to where they are right now. And we have examples every day. Because that's what trauma work is all about. People being afraid to go there and then learning to slowly breathe and open themselves up. And my book is filled with stories about people just slowly get to allow themselves to feel what they feel. And, one very important thing is that so many times people are very uptight in their bodies. When you brain scan them, you see that the insula, the part of your brain that allows you to know what's going on in your body, is very shut down. And as long as you don't know what's going on in your body, you don't know what's good for you. And you cannot take care of yourself if you have no relationship to what's underneath your chin. And so you need to be aware of your body. And so you slowly help people to just be aware of their toes and of their shoulders, and just to increase the capacity to notice themselves, basically. So that is the work process. That is the work.
Bessel had a creative way of helping clients unlock a physiological resistance. As he said, many patients may not even be aware of their own breathing patterns. Dr. Stephen Porges continues this line of thinking around the nervous system. Stephen says that there are two ways that a client can present resistance. And when this biological response gets triggered, this is how Stephen reverses it.
If we think of resistance as a defensive strategy, again, when we defend, and I'm going to basically move it back to the neurophysiology, and then you can see different modes of resistance mapping into these physiological states. So if we think of putting the person into a defensive state, and that's what resistance is, then they have two options neurophysiologically. One is a mobilization fight flight, which will be highly activated, talking in script, deflecting comments and moving into different areas, not actually listening, but producing sounds. And that's the sympathetic nervous system. That's, in psychological terms, more linked with anxiety, or in the body, people would say tightly wrapped people. So you could see all the metaphors coming out. And that's the sympathetic nervous system as a defense mode. Now, there might also be a resistance where people just go, they disappear. They don't hear. And this is, again, recruiting part of a more subdiaphragmatic shutting down immobilization response. So if resistance is, in polyvagal terms, not allowing the social engagement system to interact with the therapist, then the person would be in one of these two defensive modes, a sympathetic mobilization, which we're very aware of in clinical and in social life, and less frequently, but with more severe cases, where people just space out.
Any thoughts on working with it?
Again, the issues, I think working with resistance is, I'm going to basically say you have to treat it from an oblique perspective. Because just like the discussion about shame, where shame was neurophysiologically driven, the defense states are neurophysiologically driven as well. So how do you get people out of defense states? You shift them into a different physiological state that is more social, more calming. And you might use breathing techniques. You might use song. When I do workshops, we do a very simple breathing exercise. And the exercise is to demonstrate to the participants of the workshop that physiological state affects the way we interact with other individuals. So I have them do long inhalations and short exhalations. I have them reverse it and then do long short inhalations and long exhalations. I have them observe a person doing that and experiencing that. When they do the long inhalations, they're turning off the vagus, the myelinated vagus, and they're literally getting their bodies into defensive states. They start perceiving the person who's their observer as saying, did I do something wrong? Am I not doing this breathing correctly? They're starting seeing all this critical aspect. But when they shift the breathing pattern, they start saying, oh, what an attractive person. I'd like to get to know that person. So simple shifts in physiology trigger how we interact. So we start talking about resistance. We would say that if we can get the physiological state shifted, then there might be some spontaneous interaction.
So would you try having them experiment with different ways of breathing?
Yes. And especially I would start getting them to understand that they can use a voluntary behavior, how they breathe, to shift the physiology that they're in.
And you think that's work? That would work more with the person who responds with the flight or the fight?
The interesting question, because both fight and flight recruit similar physiology.
Tell me more.
So both fight and flight require increased metabolic output. So it's literally a common physiological system that is going to support fight or flight. But the issue is not would it be work with fight or flight, but would it work with people who kind of dissociate and drift off? And that, I would say, if they do the latter, drift off, is I would get them to get the sympathetic system on board a little bit by moving and then get them to breathing. And so there would be like stages. So the part with both either fight or flight, if you can get the person comfortable enough, and here's the critical part, a lot of people don't want to be calm because the calmness carries with it cues of immobilization, and if they were restrained, if they were abused, that calmness carries with it certain cues. So they have to have the, in a sense, a skill set to understand that they can shift physiological state through movement and through breath, and that may be the mechanism give them more resilience, which we'll get to later, in terms of being able to deal with resistance, deal with those features.
Stephen brought up an important reminder about why some clients may resist a calm, regulated state. For an interactive take on why this kind of neurobiological work is so important, let's go now to Dr. Ron Siegel.
Whenever we try to not feel something, the way we don't feel, we have the experience of not feeling something is through some form of tightening or constriction. I don't know why I didn't want to say that word, but and we can do it right now. If you'll indulge me, close your eyes and generate a little bit of sadness, something that it doesn't have to be a big thing, but just something that is a little bit of sadness. And I invite folks at home to do this, to just feel the sadness. And now do whatever it takes to try to not feel that sad feeling. Get rid of that sad feeling. And you can open your eyes again. I don't know about you, but for me, I feel an actual tightening around the sadness as an attempt to push the sensation away. And I think this is what Reich called character armor when it happens habitually and unconsciously and gets called blockages in these other systems. So I think it's very much a part of our lives. Stephen, you know, Porges calls it the sympathetic response in contrast to the just going dead, like the mouse caught in the cat's jaws, which we also do sometimes. And that looks more like falling asleep or dissociating. But what all these folks have in common is noticing that, you know, well, dreams, Freud may have said, was the railroad to the unconscious, but paying attention to these bodily sensations is another railroad to the unconscious, and finding ways to work with them, whether it's, you know, Pat Ogden trying, you know, pushing the pillows and trying different postures, or having deep massage as in bioenergetics, or doing yogic practices or Qigong movement. These are all things that address it on a physical level. And it seems to me that it really is an equally useful, if not sometimes more useful, channel for addressing these things as is, you know, discussing it verbally as we do.
As we heard, Our somatic approaches to resistance can be equally as important as our cognitive ones. In the next module, we'll highlight three effective methods for dissolving a client's resistance. I'll see you there.